This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Donald Trump announced he was running for president back in 2015, and ever since, comedians have delivered jokes and jabs about his actions and demeanor. And this, of course, is carried into the Trump presidency. Late-night talk show hosts and political satirists have used their programs to critique the administration. Here's a clip from The Daily Show in July.
Donald Trump sees the presidency the same way he sees one of his companies. Its whole purpose is to serve him and only him. The Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, recuses himself because ethics and legal norms demand it. That's good for the country, but it's unfair to Trump. Because in his mind, it defeats the whole purpose of the Justice Department, which he thinks is not to uphold the law. No, no, no. It's to do the president's bidding, right? The same way he probably thinks the purpose of the Energy Department is to charge his iPhone. Plug it in, Rick. Daddy's got a tweet.
The Daily Show on Comedy Central, that's back in July. So what is the role of late-night TV in the current political climate, and how does a program like The Daily Show set itself apart? Here to talk about that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. They join us today for another installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. Natalie is a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thanks, Frank.
And Mark Anthony Neal, chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke and author and host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
How you doing, Frank?
Let's talk about this. The specific shows in this moment, I guess maybe the big question is the role of comedy, satire, we'll call it late night, but it's cable as well. Whether or not you think that has shifted, the tone and the texture has shifted in the era of Donald Trump, Natalie?
I think it definitely has. I think that, you know, okay, so there are sort of two spheres, I think, of late night comedy. There's network, and then there's, The Daily Show and all the shows that are on cable. And I think that all have used the platform of these late night programs to, in many ways, skewer the current president, in ways that hasn't been used before. And I think it is certainly used more acutely on cable. I think The Daily Show is a great example of, especially under Trevor Noah's watch, of someone really taking the opportunity to go in and give very precise commentary on, you know, what is going on. I mean, Trevor Noah does not mince words. He tells it like it is. And I think that in this era, when we have such a conundrum of things going on in the political arena, it's necessary for people to speak truth to power. I mean, really, that's what these late night comedians are doing.
That's always been the point, I think, or at least the role of satire. But Mark, again, the question of whether or not the rules have changed so much that the presidency and the political persona of Donald Trump has changed things so much that even those rules seem to have changed.
I want to pull back a little bit. I'm old enough to remember having watched Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In and the kind of political satire that they did, political enough that it got them taken off the air very quickly. I read a piece yesterday about, how Rocky and Bullwinkle, basically introduced satire to a generation of kids. So there have always been elements of that. When we get to the 80s and we think about Ronald Reagan's presidency, you had HBO and not necessarily the news, which is really kind of the precursor to the stuff that we see that Trevor Noah and other folks have been doing. I think what's interesting in this kind of tradition and the break is really 9/11. I think post 9/11 and with all these calls of patriotism, the kind of critique that we had seen really nonstop from, like, say, Richard Nixon all the way through Carter and Reagan, that moment things shift a little bit, right? And I think comedians, musicians, a range of folks are hesitant to be openly critical of the president and leadership in that regard because of these calls, that, quote unquote, the threat of terrorism. I think what Trump has represented is that those kinds of protections that had been there for about 8 or 12 years are now gone.
So you're saying 'twas ever thus, and there was just a moment in which everything became softer and gentler.
Absolutely.
And that's why we're noticing this. Well, you know, Trevor Noah, I mean, we talked about that. We're going to talk more about The Daily Show and the diversity on The Daily Show, which was not, I mean, The Daily Show famously the least diverse, if you remember that critique, under Jon Stewart. So Trevor Noah is talking with CNN commentator Van Jones on his talk show. About this very question of sort of what do you do in the era of Trump, again, given sort of the role of news and comedy and television in general?
You are somebody that I look at, I study. I'm trying to figure out how to, because you got a platform. You are a brother with a platform. I'm a brother with a platform.
Yeah.
It's not that many of us that have these opportunities.
That's true.
I'm gonna be real.
That's very true.
I'm gonna be real.
Yeah, that's true.
And so what I want to say to you is, I wake up worried, man. I feel the stress of feeling like I'm in a catch-22. I feel like we have to debunk Trump and all other people, you know, phony people. It's not just Republicans. We got to debunk those folks.
Uh-huh.
But I also worry that when we do what we do, are we adding to the polarization? Are we trying to fight polarization with polarization? Do you worry about that kind of stuff when you're doing your thing?
You know, sometimes I worry about it, but the thing I've come to realize is you've got to be careful that you don't push it so far that you are empathizing. You should understand where people are coming from, but be careful of putting yourself in their position, because then you will justify why people do what they do, things that you may not agree with.
CNN political commentator Van Jones talking with Daily Show host Trevor Noah, and I am talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. What about that?
I mean, it's interesting to be doing this show and talking about this subject on the heels of the last hour of 1A, given the interview that Joshua Johnson did with Brené Brown, I think her name is, who's a researcher who has a book out on this very topic of empathy and the need to, you know, put yourself in someone else's place and really kind of lean in order to break up the polarization that we're dealing with. I am so torn about that thing because, you know, on the one hand, I think that it is necessary to make the commentary. It's necessary to call people out. It's necessary to address the injustice and the racism and all of that. And I certainly don't want to empathize to the point that I justify any sort of white supremacist, neo-Nazi tendencies, inclinations, what have you. But at the same time, you know, we're all humans, right? We're all people with friends who have varying degrees of thought and political orientation around these issues. And so it's hard. It's hard to, you know, do the work of, you know, pointing out what needs to be pointed out, but at the same time relating to each other on a humanistic level.
Yeah.
So I
think some of the late night satire that we're starting to see is also playing catch up. It's playing catch up with social media. Social media, mm-hmm. I think, is the other shift that has changed. And the fact that President Trump himself is so engaged in social media, you know, makes it a whole different kind of conversation. I think what we see about social media, and that's reflecting on the very conversation we're just talking about on 1A, is this lack of civility, right? Civility has been lost. And I think late night television is in this interesting kind of space where they're trying to chase audiences and chase the kind of audience that's interested in these exchanges in a social media realm.
Right. Right.
But it's also fairly traditional television in that regard. So they're trying to find a middle ground.
Yeah.
And the one thing they can't do, they have to maintain civility, even if social media doesn't. So while they can push against certain kind of edges, there still is a space where they can cross a line that someone on Twitter doesn't have those kind of constraints.
And there's a difference between professional protocols, too, and also if getting back to empathy. You know, you're sitting across the dinner table with somebody you don't agree with. They voted in a way that you didn't vote, and they're a relative. All right, let's empathize and figure out how you got there. And then there are the pros. There are the people who are in office who mine deliberately and figure out ways to tear at the fabric and hurt the national and when you see a professional at work is deliberately benefiting by these things, then I think it's fair to sort of tee off and say, wait a minute, I see what's going on there. Let's tear down the curtain here and expose this thing.
Absolutely. And I think that there's a way, well, in that type of instance, Frank, that you just described, when we're dealing with professionals, as you put it, I think the gloves have to come off, because now you're dealing with, you know, constructs, people who are in power, who actually have the ability to affect all of our lives. But, you know, Trevor Noah, to get back to him, you know, I was really impressed with the way that he handled his interview of Tommy Lahren, you know, the young conservative radio talk show host who skewers, you know, everything that is essentially progressive and on the left. And I, you know, he, talking about civility, Trevor is very civil, but he does not let her off the hook. He keeps at her and keeps challenging her on the issues and on the things that she says. You know, I think that he does that for a living. It's difficult when we have to do it in the, you know, in the human realm.
Well, let's just play a quick clip from that, and then we're going to take a break. This is Trevor Noah, in fact, talking to Tommy Lahren.
I mean, I've never used racial slurs to address people. I've never looked down on someone because of their skin color. To me, true diversity is diversity of thought, not diversity of color. I don't see color. I go after Hillary Clinton and she is white as they come.
You don't see color. So what do you do at a traffic light? I don't believe in that at all.
That's a clip from The Daily Show last year. My guest, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal, on another edition of Back Channel, connecting culture and context. We'll talk more about satire and also remember one of the great satirists and social critics of all time, Dick Gregory. That and much, much more on The State of Things continues. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. They're with me for another installment of Back Channel, connecting culture and context. Today, talking about late night television, political satire. Let's talk about the different tones. Mark, you talked about catching up, the networks catching up. And in your case, you were talking about social media. But then there's Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show, who's been catching up ever since Donald Trump was elected. The criticism, of course, of Fallon is that he has not been sharp enough in his critique. So here he is in the aftermath of Charlottesville talking on The Tonight Show.
Even though The Tonight Show isn't a political show, it's my responsibility to stand up against intolerance and extremism as a human being. What happened over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, was just disgusting. I was watching the news like everyone else, and you're seeing like Nazi flags and torches and white supremacists, and I was sick to my stomach. My daughters are in the next room playing, and I'm thinking, how can I explain to them that there's so much hatred in this world? They're 2 years old and 4 years old. They don't know what hate is.
That's a clip from The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon last month. I'm talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, you know, what strikes me about that clip is that he seemed to feel the need to break from comedy. In other words, okay, I have to go outside the show to express my true feelings. And then you've got Trevor Noah saying, hey, hang on a second. This is how I feel is important, and I'm not going to let that get subsumed into the there were mistakes made by both sides kind of a false equivalence.
If you look at Jimmy Fallon and, say, Stephen Colbert, and to look rating-wise what Stephen Colbert has done to The Tonight Show brand since the election of Donald Trump, you know, Jimmy Fallon is much more interested, and it's part of his brand, in being liked, and liked by all sides, right? There's no question that his show comes off that way, right? He wants to be liked. He wants to be cool. So you have the roots, but you divorce the roots from very real political issues that they have represented for 20 years. You know, the minute that he mushes Donald Trump's hair, you know, when Trump is still on the campaign, for me, that said everything that I needed to see about who Jimmy Fallon was going to be in this new, you know, media ecosystem. Meanwhile, Colbert, you know, it's still funny, right? But he realizes that, you know, there's a different kind of target now. He's not there to be liked. He's there to have cutting, biting edge comedy. And he'll see the likeness, you know, quotient to Jimmy Fallon and do what he's done. He's been successful.
Well, ironically, it worked. And people are liking him more than Jimmy Fallon for the first time ever.
Right.
You know, late night
right.
is actually topped him in the ratings.
But I think people, you know, I think, as I said earlier or tried to say, I think that in this era, because of who is in office, people, I mean, we certainly need the lightness of a Jimmy Fallon, but I think there is so much mess that has to be navigated on a daily basis in the news cycle, and all the false news and the alternative news, and you know, all these ways that the current White House administration tries to spin stuff, that you know, someone needs to just call it as it is. And I think that that is why someone like Stephen Colbert or Trevor Noah is doing better in ratings than a Jimmy Fallon.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the other reasons for that change. Trevor Noah talks about the question of diversity, a much more diverse staff on The Daily Show than under Jon Stewart, still a comedy show and a satire show. And here he is talking about his approach to addressing problems with diversity. He's talking to NPR's Linda Wertheimer in 2015.
The hardest thing to do is acknowledging that you have a problem. So this is what often happens, I feel. Let's say in America, it's the same in South Africa, you'll have a lot of white people who are liberal, people who are progressive, people who are going, I want change, I vote for change, this is what I agree with this, I believe there should be more integration, I believe that, and I'm for it 100%. And then they'll say things like, and I believe in equal opportunities, so everyone can interview for this job. What people don't realize is, just because of the world we've lived in, because of the limitations that have been placed on the access that people of color and women have had to getting to those positions, the networks that we use to try and get to them are limited. So you say, I've opened this position up to anybody. Black people are welcome to apply. Do black people hear that application invitation? You know, women are welcome to, do women hear that application invitation? You end up being trapped in a cycle of not hiring anyone because you think you're open, you genuinely do. You go, I'm hiring anybody, but the anybodies that happen to come there will always be the same people because the people you talk to, your friends and your colleagues, are the same. Hey, do you know any good people? Yeah, I know some good people. And those people are always going to be the same.
That's Trevor Noah talking with NPR's Linda Holmes in 2015. So here's what's funny about the mistake I made going into that clip. I said Linda Wertheimer. Why? Because I know personally Linda Wertheimer. So my default when I see a Linda in NPR's is to go to Linda Wertheimer. I think this is getting to exactly what I've got a preset. And when I see Linda, I go Wertheimer because I don't know Linda Holmes personally. I mean, right. It seemed to me that this was an object lesson, my little error, making lemonade here on the
yes.
State of Things. But anyway, what about that comment?
Yes.
I listened to that clip and I feel like I'm talking to an upper administration at Duke around these same issues, right? And so Trevor Noah, in some ways, probably has more impact in terms of at least changing his staff than many other institutions that, you know, at least give some sort of lip service to a commitment to diversity, but are unwilling to bring people into the room that actually will allow them to actually achieve that diversity that they claim that they want.
Yeah, no, it's about networks and about breaking those things open. And we'll talk more about that as we get into some of the other kind of media questions that we're gonna comment on. Well, let's talk, too, about the tone. I want to, before we leave this subject entirely, talk about The Daily Show and just the way in which it's approaching some of these questions. And again, there's a question of whether or not we're going to bridge this gap. Is it, you know, is it culture and not racism? And should we all get together and have a beer? Or do we need to sort of address these things frontally? Questions about Confederate monuments and the ways in which we may remember the Confederacy for one. So here we are, Trevor Noah. This is a program that features correspondents who talk about issues like the removal of Confederate statues. And here is correspondent Roy Wood Jr. talking with Trevor Noah.
I know y'all want to keep your statues, but here's the thing. Slavery is a trauma that black people to this day are still dealing with. And to have to look at those statues, like basically this was like, right? Like basically, it's like if a woman got out of an abusive relationship and then she had to keep pictures of her ex up in her house to remember the time. Like, no, I don't need pictures to remember pain.
You know, actually, now that you bring it up, it's funny you say that because you think about this and people say, we want to remember the history of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. I always think there's an easier way to remember what happened in the Civil War. Just walk around in the South, and if you see free black people, then you know what happened in the Civil War.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with that, exactly.
Like, that's what happened.
That's a clip of The Daily Show on Comedy Central last month. I'm talking with Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on this edition of Back Channel. I mean, we heard a preamble there that was not very funny, right? And then we get into the punchline.
I mean, I think that, you know, again, Trevor Noah is, I think he is perfecting something that Jon Colbert.
Jon Stewart.
I'm sorry, Jon Stewart. tried to merge two people, you know, began. And I think, you know, Trevor Noah, to me, he has, he's very nuanced in his understanding. It's very interesting that he's from South Africa, and so he's sort of a outsider in that way. But, you know, and maybe that's what helps him to be able to see so precisely, you know, what's going on in American culture around race. But I also think that, you know, because of the platform that he has, you know, he and this understanding, this insight that he has, he's very expertly been able to weave comedy and commentary together in a way that is, you know, that works and is appealing. And I think he's getting through, like, I think he's punching through some of the barriers that exist to us even being able to hear what perhaps we should be thinking about in this discourse.
I think one of the things that's great about, you know, say someone like Roy Wood is that, you know, there's a way in which Trevor Noah is not every man. All right. I mean, once he opens his mouth, right, he's something exceptional and special, exotic even. But Roy Wood is an everyman, right? Every person, right? So when he weighs in on these things, it kind of grounds it in everyday life. I mean, it feels the way that I felt about, say, the late Charlie Murphy and the way that he pivoted against this kind of exceptionalism that was Dave Chappelle.
Yeah.
I think to be effective satire, right? And it's not even a straight man piece, right? It's just something, someone who's accessible to your audience, someone that your audience can imagine riding a bus going to work and they're sitting next to you and saying the same things to you on the bus that they're saying, you know, on Trevor Noah's show.
Right.
And they never abandon the whole idea of showbiz. I mean, in every one of those bits, there's one about, you know, sort of at one point, Roy Wood says, yes, and then, and remember when Barack Obama agreed to pay reparations, and then he kind of finishes the shtick, and Trevor says, well, hold it. Reparations, and then he turns around and it was a play in an earlier line, and he said, "Who?" I mean, the point is he then allows the shtick, which is just pure any, you know, sort of a comedy, to be part of the routine. In other words, they really can't abandon showbiz when they do this. This has got to be a show.
Yeah,
and this is maybe the mistake that a guy like Lenny Bruce made ultimately, right? And Mort Saul to a lesser degree.
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, one of the clips that I looked at last night of Trevor Noah was, oh gosh, I can't remember the name of the correspondent, but she's a black woman, and she, they're talking about diversity, I believe, and Trevor makes a comment about big butts, and she just, you know, stops and touches her heart and is just so moved.
Because he's like, I like big butts.
Exactly. And she says, thank you, you know? And I was like, that's perfect. I mean, where else on television anywhere are you going to see that type of interplay that, you know, speaks to the heart of, like, issues within black culture? But this is, you know, it's not elevated, but it's within the context of popular culture. You know, I just thought it was so well played. And I think that, again, Trevor Noah he's become really good at that type of presentation.
It was Dulce Sloan that he was talking with there. Well, so let's move on a little bit and talk about the loss of Dick Gregory, who also brought satire and social critique to high art. A comedian, satirist, and political activist died last month. Tell us more about Dick Gregory, Mark.
Amazing. I mean, he really set the bar for black comedic talent in the 1960s, you know, where someone like Red Fox was still not able to be mainstream. You know, Dick Gregory was in the mainstream. He was on shows like Dick Cavett and things of that nature. But he was also very willing, you know, as he's wearing his suits and his ties, he's also very willing to talk about race in ways that we had not seen among a black comedian, right? And you really can't understand the trajectory of Bill Cosby and Richard Pryor. You know, Richard Pryor in some ways cuts the difference between a Dick Gregory, a mature Dick Gregory, and a mature Bill Cosby. You know, we can't imagine that landscape without the kind of impact that Dick Gregory had, right? He was one of the most well-paid black comedians, you know, in the 1960s, the most visible. He's on these talk shows, which is important, right? He's not just doing his comedy routine, but then he's sitting in the seat, you know, next to the host, actually talking about some of the critical issues that are occurring.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, I mean, it was precisely because of the nature of his comedy that I think talk show hosts felt comfortable saying, well, let's have him on and talk with him about these issues in ways that you might not with other comedians. I mean, let's listen to a bit of, and his routines, he was, in many cases, certainly working before white audience, gets his big start at the Playboy Club, right? Because Irwin Corey didn't show up. You remember Professor Irwin Corey. Anyway, that's how he gets his start. Here he is in his early days of comedy at a club in San Francisco.
And you heard what Bobby Kennedy said about 8 weeks ago. He said, 30 years from this year, a Negro can become president. So treat me right, or I'll get in there and raise taxes on you. I mean, now don't get me wrong. I wouldn't mind paying my income tax if I knew it was going to a friendly country.
That's Dick Gregory from the early 1960s. I'm talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. If we left a little bit more on there, you would have heard the laughter. There's a slight delay. It's the audience going, but I get it. You know, I mean, it's sort of interesting to think about it back in those days.
Well, I think that delay is kind of what I experienced with Dick Gregory because, I mean, Mark and I are basically of the same generation, but my orientation around Dick Gregory didn't come until much later. I did not get him when I was younger. I mean, I really didn't. I think because his satire, I mean, it's the type of satire that you have to be informed. Like, you have to know what he's talking about, and I wasn't that politically informed. So now I can appreciate him. In his last 10 years, in a way that I couldn't when he was probably at his peak. And I would think that most people my age and younger probably have that same sort of, I mean, depending on your level of exposure to someone like him and also your understanding of how he lines up in that comedic black comedy lineage. You'd have a similar orientation around him, but he's absolutely important. I see that.
One of the things I think is so stunning about Dick Gregory is just to think about his longevity, you know, from that period of time where he's very famous in the 1960s and he willfully kind of pulls back. He becomes a different kind of figure, becomes much more political, right, in ways that cost him opportunities, yeah, right, to make a living. You know, he buys this huge farm and raises his 10 kids. The next thing you know, when I'm introduced to him as a young kid, when my parents are like, oh, Dick Gregory's on TV, and you sit there and you watch it. But, I'm a college student when I get reintroduced to Dick Gregory, and he's selling, you know, the diet, right? He's talking about healthcare issues.
Yeah.
And I think when we think about a mature Dick Gregory, particularly the last 10 years, it was his commitment to talking about conspiracy theories, right? And we never really knew how many of these conspiracy theories that Dick Gregory actually believed, but there was always such a germ of truth.
Right.
And knowledge in what he was talking about, the whole performance of it allowed him actually to tell some truths that we wouldn't normally hear, right? And I think that played an important role in terms of when everybody is kind of suspect of everything that's happening. You know, Dick Gregory was always like, let's take a moment to pause, right? And let's look at a bigger picture. And some of that stuff, I think, was important for him to articulate.
Didn't that hurt his credibility, though? I mean, because some of them did seem a bit outlandish. And it wasn't so much, not that the conspiracies were impossible. They're not impossible. There are people in power who can do everything that he says they can do.
Right.
And some of it, I'm sure they did. The problem was he really kind of didn't back it up, and then there was a lot of profane energy behind it.
The question is credibility for who? You know, he had long been less interested in kind of the white mainstream gaze, right? He had been done with that for almost 30 years. I mean, when he's selling this diet in the early 1980s and showing up at Louis Farrakhan's Savior's Day, you know, he had pretty much given up on this idea that white America would be interested in anything he had to say. But again, I think there was just a bit of historical knowledge there that if you're young, you at least had to listen. And if you were inclined, you could go do your own research.
Yeah. I was going to say that Dick Gregory had a huge level of elder privilege where he could talk about whatever he wanted to in whatever way he wanted to. I mean, I remember hearing him speak for like 2 hours straight at, I think it was the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer. And he was the keynote. And he talked and talked and talked and talked and talked. And nobody stopped him. I mean, but only Dick Gregory. Only someone like Dick Gregory could do that. And people actually walk away from him saying, that Dick Gregory, he's good. You know, he really had something to say, you know?
Yeah, no, it is powerful. And it's the art of that kind of theater at large that I think is probably the meta message that he finally got, that theater. I mean, if you get the kind of politics of professional wrestling that has now become American politics, right, that the heel can actually ascend to the highest, you know, to high office. There's something about that sort of bombastic presentation. Mm-hmm. And if you're in showbiz long enough and devoted to social action long enough, you might be able to put those two things together.
You know, I think one of the things I think we miss about Dick Gregory that he probably never got enough credit for. I mean, he one of his things, he was a stand-up comedian, right? But he was much more in the tradition of a satirist in the way that we think about, say, a Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. And he continued that role. I mean, CBS this morning, Sunday morning, did a profile of him about 2 months before his death. And what struck me about that profile is that they were recovering that aspect of who Dick Gregory was, right? Someone who played with fiction, who played with history, who played with satire, right, to tell important stories about race and identity in American society in the way that Mark Twain has been elevated in that regard. We had not seen that same elevation of someone like Dick Gregory. And in fact, you'd be hard-pressed to think about who Dick Gregory's peers are in that regard over the last 40 or 50 years.
Well, very quickly, what's his legacy? I mean, is there a real lineage between him and some of what we're seeing today, or is it a broken?
I think definitely just Chappelle is the one person who stands out, right, particularly as Chappelle decided to pull away from the mainstream. It was very Dick Gregory-like. And I could imagine Chappelle and Dick Gregory might have had some conversations at some point about how he managed, how Chappelle chose to manage his fame.
On the State of Things Today, back channel, Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown. Just ahead, we're going to talk about a recent docuseries and much, much more on the State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on another installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. Natalie, let's switch gears here. Talk about a recent docuseries called The Defiant Ones on HBO, which tells the story of the musical partnership between Dr. Dre and music producer Jimmy Iovine. Talk more about this project and why it's so interesting to you.
Well, as a documentary filmmaker, I feel like The Defiant Ones is a really compelling piece of storytelling. It's a four-part series that was aired on HBO, I guess a month or two ago. And it one of the things that I love about it, although it definitely is not, perfect, there are certainly things that are left out. That probably should have been talked about. But one, I love that the Hughes brothers, who were responsible for Menace to Society, as well as other films, Dead Presidents as well, right? Mm-hmm. They are behind. Alan Hughes is the one who directs the film. I think we get like a really intimate glimpse, not even a glimpse, like we kind of go deep into who Dr. Dre is. And Dr. Dre is someone that you don't get a lot of interviews from. Like I've not seen a lot of interviews of him, sort of out there in pop culture. So it's very intimate in that way. And then Jimmy Iovine is like a revelation. If you're not really familiar with his role in the music industry and specifically in hip hop, it's very interesting to learn about how these two lives merge, and how they were really on, although they were on two separate tracks, they lived parallel lives in many ways.
Yeah, I think that's it. Let's listen to the trailer, because again, Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre, in many ways, an unlikely partnership until you see this and see precisely why they had so much in common. Let's listen to the trailer.
This was that Do or Die album. Put my body into this record. I'm playing it for everybody. For some reason, everybody's turning me down.
Nobody wanted to deal with this gangster rap thing. They were afraid to deal with the people.
The East Coast ain't got no love for Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg.
Interscope crossed the line of decency.
All I remember is that Dre came in to play us the Chronic. I said, who recorded this for you? He said, me. I said, wow, this guy will define Interscope.
That's a clip from the trailer of the HBO docuseries, The Defiant Ones, talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So tell us about the two subjects of this film.
I'm with Natalie. Jimmy Iovine was a revelation, right? This is a guy who gets started as a sound recorder. you know, doing sound engineer work with John Lennon, right? You know, who's in a torrid love affair with Stevie Nicks, right? And so the music nerd part of me, the 1970s, 80s pop music nerd,
right,
love that part of the story, right? Because I've always had this, like, this theory, right, that when I hear Erykah Badu, what I'm hearing is not Billie Holiday. What I'm actually hearing is Stevie Nicks.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And when you see that Iovine and his relationship with Stevie Nicks is like, and then when you think about Erykah Badu sampling, you know, she and Dr. Dre using the same samples, like, oh, yeah, you know, this is like confirmation, right?
It
makes sense. The thing that's also I thought was so important about getting this intimate view with Dr. Dre, right? You know, Dr. Dre has been framed by who he is as a producer. There's no question, right? He's the most important producer, and I would argue in pop music, you know, over the last 25 years. He just changed the sound of pop music, period. But the other part of the narrative about Dr. Dre is, in fact, about gender violence, right? His situation with Dee Barnes. What was beautiful about The Defiant Ones is that it created a space for Dee Barnes not only to be who she was and to acknowledge who she was in hip-hop. You know, she just wasn't someone who was a hanger-on, but someone who was contributing how we thought about hip-hop at the time, but also allowed her to speak back to Dr. Dre's violence. And there's some moment of rehabilitation, I think, that occurs there. What we forget, Dr. Dre is 51 years old. That beatdown occurred when he was 20.
And right? The assault on
Dean Barr. So in some ways, he's actually been apologizing and trying to make retribution for that for the last 30 years of his life, right? And we very rarely get to see the fullness of that narrative as we see in The Defiant Ones.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to play that clip because she does talk about that and that very idea, Mark, that this has been, you know, an important part of Dr. Dre's career. Let's listen.
I called the police on Mr. the police. But little by little, the work started drying up. It was as if I had ruined his career by being that disturbing footnote in his legacy.
That's TV host Dee Barnes on The Defiant Ones on HBO, talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal.
Well, that clip basically sets up what I was going to say, because I'm not sure that I agree that Dr. Dre has been apologizing for, you know, the past 30 years. I think that he may have made some attempt at an apology and, you know, and then was like, you know, F that B from then on. Mm-hmm. Certainly none of what happened with Dee Barnes is even addressed in Straight Outta Compton, the feature film on, you know, mm-hmm. N.W.A. Yeah. So I was touched. I mean, I have to say, I appreciated the fact that in The Defiant Ones, Dr. Dre finally seems to express remorse, like real, true, heartfelt remorse for the ways that he not only treated Dee Barnes, but women in general. And so that's a good thing. But I, you know, it's unfortunate that it takes a documentary of this magnitude for him to get to the point where we can see that. Because I think hip hop and I think, you know, survivors of sexual assault have needed that from him for a long time. So it was good that he did it.
And maybe it's the very, very nature of the documentary. It's like when you put it together in one place, now you get to see, you know, sort of a concentrated view. The business side of this, I think, is also important. I mean, Iovine, you talked about him being a recording engineer. And the famous story of him, apocryphal or not, is that, you know, he's recording for people like John Lennon. And then he figures out that if you're a producer, you get pennies on the dollar. It's like $800,000 if you're a producer, and I'm getting $10 an hour as a recording artist, which is to say that business plays an important role. So not only having your finger on the pulse and understanding what's going to work musically and creatively, but also figuring out the business angle.
And then we'll be willing to cross the line in terms of vulgar product in order to achieve those business goals, right? And, you know, Dr. Dre and N.W.A. and those gangster rap gets a lot of heat for that. But it's really Jimmy Iovine who's financing that, right? And not just in terms of Dr. Dre, but with Marilyn Manson and all these other kind of folks, right? On the one hand, he understood where the market was going. But he was also willing to cross any line that he could cross in order to be successful, you know, in the context of this market.
And you were talking about Alan Hughes and his importance in this. This is the director, Alan Hughes. And he was talking about his approach to this project.
With Dre, I mean, I think there's a mysterious quality that's always been there with him. So to try to find him between the lines, to try to find the man, you know, the young man, the older man, the artist, the producer, that was a challenge with Dre. But we've grown up with Dre, you know, like we've seen him reinvent himself time and time again. So we're familiar with Dre. So I looked at this kind of like the way I looked at when I saw Goodfellas, going into Goodfellas, we knew who Robert De Niro was. He was cool as f, and we were in. And then all of a sudden, this guy, Joe Pesci, we never heard of before, really. He's just so colorful and so dynamic. I knew that about Jimmy, but I also knew Jimmy was the Wizard of Oz. He stayed behind the curtain his whole career. He was the ultimate collaborator, and he was the ultimate champion of artists, especially Dre. And so, but what you don't know is whether that'll translate to the screen. And so that was exciting to see that he actually did translate.
Filmmaker Alan Hughes on his approach to The Defiant Ones, talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony. I think this also raises a question that's been a sort of an undercurrent in this whole conversation, which is this kind of genius, understanding the business of entertainment, and also that entertainment really does have to tap into something that's actually real. Whatever artifice it appears on stage, it has to tap into something real, anxieties, hopes, aspirations of the American or the record-buying public.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's what I see in these two artists. Both Jimmy and Dre are able, they have like this impulse, this intuition about people and about music. But I think one of the things that I really respect about Dre, you know, that makes a lot of sense in terms of, you know, who he is and his success, is that he seems to be someone who has always trusted his gut. And I think that you know, that speaks to a sensibility and a sensitivity that we may not attribute to someone like Dre, you know, given N.W.A. and gangster rap and all of that. But, you know, Mark referred to himself as a music nerd. I feel like I'm kind of one of those too. But Dre is totally a music nerd. I mean, the types of music that he draws from, you know, and the way that these different types of genres of music speak to him, I think that also, you know, informs us in a way about who he is deep down, because you can't be interested in Kraftwerk and Kurt Cobain and Nirvana and gangster rap and, you know, and like have a 20-year marriage. Like there's something deeper, right, that's going on.
When we see him in the studio, right, and his attention to detail, right, and of course the infamous detox, which he tells us is never going to come out because it doesn't live up to his standards, right? And so we see an interiority about him that we rarely have ever seen about Dr. Dre or most black men in general, let alone folks who are attached to hip-hop. I mean, that's part of what Jay-Z does with 444, right? It gives us some sense of the interiority of the man.
Yeah.
But when you see him in the studio and how locked in he is, right, you recognize that this is for real musical genius, right? This is something that he's worked on. He's looked for the technology to create what he wanted to hear in his head, right? And you can think about, like, you know, the genius sitting there with these sounds in his head trying to figure out how that can translate in a way that the world can hear. And there isn't quite the technology for it yet, right? So it's almost like he's on this ongoing search to find the technology that's going to allow him to express what he's hearing in his head.
Now let's talk about this from the consumer side, Natalie. The changes in the way we're consuming media, a lot of people cutting the cord these days, not watching so much television, streaming media. I mean, tell us about the trends here and how you see all of this playing out with streaming media becoming much more important now in the American public, American viewing public.
Well, it seems, and I think the research bears this out, that people prefer streaming media, Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, over network television, you know, in overwhelming numbers. And I'm basing this on research that I read from 2015. So we can only assume that it has grown since then, this appeal to being able to watch what you want to watch when you want to watch it, and the convenience of that, and the control that it really gives consumers over the content that they're consuming.
Well, I mean, we've got Shonda Rhimes, producer, extraordinaire writer, most famous for hit shows like Grey's Anatomy and Scandal, recently signs a multi-year deal with Netflix, and so has sort of abandoned network TV and moved to streaming video.
I keep wondering what streaming TV is going to do with the archive of like the American soap opera. Because if anything seemed like it was tailor-made for streaming media, you know, the American soap opera of the 1970s and the 80s, All My Children and stuff like that, right. It would be an interesting reclamation project.
Yeah.
But I think it is a way, again, of the technology catching up to the habits of younger folks. Whose the idea of a schedule is so much more in flux. This idea of appointment television, you know, doesn't work, you know, if right. you're 18 and 19
That's
years
right.
old. The idea of finding a television, you right. know, doesn't work, right?
right?
It's so much easier to sit there at your leisure with your computer, on your phone, on your iPad, or what have you. And the technology has finally gotten there. And I mean, we were talking off air, you know, before we got started. It makes you wonder where the networks go now.
Right.
Because so many folks don't watch the network, but they watch the network app.
Right.
Right.
Right. You know, they're not watching AB. They're not watching, you know, Scandal. Well, they might watch Scandal because of the community aspect of watching right. it. But outside of that, you know, folks are watching stuff individually by themselves.
That's right. Right. And again, doing it, you know, when they want to, when it's convenient for them.
I'm just so curious why the networks don't cut the cord themselves. I mean, they wring their hands and come up with these kind of complicated deals with Hulu and other kind of different platforms. It's like, let's just stop it. And we can still produce NCIS. I'm sure there's some subset or some number of viewers who just have to turn on their TV at 8 o'clock Thursday, but that's vanishingly small. They'll get the app if they want NCIS.
The interesting thing, I think, is that also with this new shift, it's not as celebrity and star-driven.
That's right.
Right, so
yes.
you don't need A-list yep. stars now to drive eyeballs to these projects, right? You know, when folks are watching Luke Cage, they don't really know who the star Luke Cage is, right? He becomes a star in the context of the show. And I think that changes the economy of this for this, right?
Right.
I think it makes it a different stakes for celebrities as they're choosing whether or not to do a Hollywood project versus doing a smaller screen project now where they might actually connect with more eyeballs than they would in a traditional television
And you don't
show.
Have to limit yourself. You can take it off your smartphone and squirt it onto your TV. I mean, there's no, right. nothing stopping you
right.
from doing that. And the content as well. And I think you made reference to this. A lot more liberty in what you can produce on streaming than what you can do on network.
That's right.
right.
And I think that a part of the reason, at least what I've read in terms of why Netflix wanted someone like Shonda Rhimes is because she is regarded as one of the best storytellers, you know, over the past, 15, 20
yeah.
years.
Mm-hmm.
And so for her, I mean, I can definitely see the benefit of going to a Netflix because now she's not restricted by the regulations of network television, right? She can come up with anything. And I think that in general, the environment on in streaming land is it liberates, I think, creators of content and allows them to address issues and talk about things that, you know, in ways that you can't do on network television. And I think that's really important for just the public discourse.
Well,
and
a lot of people drown in that freedom, but a great writer and a great storyteller never will. They'll
right.
always figure it out, whatever the platform. Out of time again, sadly. We're talking with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark is the chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. He's an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Mark, always a pleasure.
Thank you, as always, Frank.
Natalie Bullock Brown, a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh and an Emmy-nominated producer and filmmaker. Natalie, good to see you again.
It was great to be here.
You can find out more about this show at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton, Ormond Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.